Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, February 7th, 2011. Senator Carlson, it's nice to see you here today, as it
Thank
is
you, Mr.
everybody
Chairman.
Else. You know, we've got a tight agenda here today, but before we move forward, there's something very special that happened last week, and I just want everybody to meet this organization. So the first item on the agenda is the introduction from Defending the Blue Line. Last week, Governor Dayton recently declared, well, actually, February 1st, as Defending the Blue Line Day in the state of Minnesota. So I decided to invite the committee to give a brief overview of their work, because I truly believe when it comes to our veterans, items like this deserve some attention more than they normally get. So first of all, I'd like to call up Dan Larson, Defending the Blue Line Advisory Board, and if you want to bring the other members up with you, Dan, and then I'll let you introduce them and give us a small overview. Make sure that you say your name for the record before you speak, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dan Larson, representing the Defending the Blue Line Club today, organization, I should say. I am on the an advisory board member, so thank you so much for the opportunity to come here. We are a nonprofit volunteer organization, and we are trying, our effort currently is to try and raise the profile of the group, so this helps immeasurably for this group, which at its core was started by soldiers for the purpose of keeping military hockey families in the game through the ongoing stresses of deployments and ongoing training. So thank you again, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be very brief. We've got Shane Hudella, who is the president and founder of Defending the Blue Line, and then a family. We brought Heather Rank here today, and the star of the show is TJ, who is a squirt at Pine City. And we also have a brief clip from last week. You referenced the show or the program that we had last week. So thank you very much.
You bet, Dan. Who's next?
I think if we could we play the...
That's fine with me. That's
we got a minute and a half clip here, and then probably Shane, and we'll get into Heather and TJ.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Nick Bielum plays hockey. Do you like it how much?
A very lot.
A very lot. Brother Samuel says it's a huge part of his life.
So you wake up.
Play hockey.
Go to sleep.
Play hockey.
I got it.
But for these Minnesota kids and hundreds of others like them,
I love hockey.
Skating for a team isn't a sure thing.
We're actually scheduled to deploy this spring.
Because one of their parents, sometimes both, are soldiers.
Our mission is to keep hockey alive for the children of our nation's heroes.
Defending the Blue Line is a Minnesota-born organization. Its goal is to keep the children of Minnesota soldiers playing Minnesota's game, even when mom or dad are gone.
We have to rely on friends to help drive.
I hate to see that hockey go by the wayside, so that's where we step in and help out.
With rides to practice and games, help with association fees, camps.
We've had the opportunity to get equipment when maybe times haven't been, you know, where we've been able to provide that for our kids.
With great pride and humility that I announce today in Minnesota is Defending the Blue Line Day.
Today at the Capitol, the charity got a proclamation for working to keep kids skating.
It's that important.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, sir, ladies and gentlemen. Definitely appreciate your time this afternoon. My name is Shane Hudella, and I'm the president and founder of Defending the Blue Line. Appreciate you having us today. Just wanted to say a few words about what we do and some of the programs that we've run. Started out about 2 years ago, myself and another National Guard member that's passionate about hockey and the military as well. We had seen a lot of our buddies, both in the Army Guard and the Air Guard and the other services, come and go from multiple deployments since 9/11. So we decided to tap our resources and our passion for hockey and help provide a benefit to families in Minnesota and potentially other parts of the United States. So we formed the organization Defending the Blue Line. We do four main programs. The first is equipment. We've provided equipment to over 100 military kids so far, with hockey being probably the most expensive sport there is out there, and I'm not sure if we have any hockey parents in the room or not. If there are, you know our pain.
Hockey grandparents,
yes, sir. So we decided it's a way for us to be able to help provide equipment for the kids. A lot of times, especially in the reserve components, these families have been impacted by the economy, just like everybody else. So if we can provide equipment and make the difference for whether or not that young military child plays hockey or not, we think that's a pretty great thing. So we do the equipment. We've provided a few grants to help with local association fees. We've sent almost 700 family members down to an NHL game now for free through partnerships with some of the NHL players, such as Brent Burns. In the last piece, we've done a number of summer hockey camps for kids. And TJ and Heather both came to a camp that we did over in Spooner, Wisconsin last year. It's such a great way for keeping these kids active and providing an outlet for them to relieve stress that may be caused from a deployment or extended training or even just that uncertainty of if my mom or dad is going to have to go somewhere this year. So last summer we sent about 300 kids to different hockey camps in the metro area here, outstate Minnesota and over in Spooner, Wisconsin. Pardon? Free of charge, yep, all these programs we provide at no fee for the service members. So just wanted to bring these guys here today and give them an opportunity to tell you folks about some of the things that we've done and just to help raise awareness for our group and raise the profile for us. We've been amazed but not surprised by the outpouring of support from Minnesotans, both in the political community, the business community, and just general population that's taken up our cause for us. So with that, I'll turn it over to Heather and TJ, and if you guys want to just tell them a little bit about some of the things that we've done.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for welcoming us today. My name is Heather Rank. My husband, Tony Rank, is a member of the Air National Guard in Minnesota. He's been a member of the Air National Guard for 11 years, and of those 11 years, he's been deployed twice to the Middle East. We do have our one son, TJ, who has a passion for hockey, and thanks to Defending the Blue Line, TJ's been able to go to some of these camps during the summer free of charge. Our family probably wouldn't have been able to afford to send him to some of those camps, so we've been very grateful for what Defending the Blue Line has done for us. TJ's also gotten some equipment. His prized possession is a camouflage hockey stick right now. And he's gotten a lot of equipment. I think Defending the Blue Line, like I said, has been great for our family. It's boosted our son's confidence out on the ice, and it's also helped him identify that there are other children who have military members that are being deployed or that are gone that are also involved in hockey.
Thanks, Heather. Why don't we hear from TJ? I mean, he is a star of the show. TJ Rank, why don't you say hello to the committee and tell them how Defending the Blue Line, what it's done for you.
Hi, my name is TJ Rank. I'm a hockey player at Pine City. And, well, what it's done for me is, well, helped me identify a lot better that I am not the only military kid that is in hockey, and it's helped me a little bit with my skills and how important the sides of the hockey blade is. And they've given me a some equipment, which has been really helpful. In specific, shin pads. My older shin pads were getting a little bit too small, I can say. And they've helped me a lot, boosting my energy and knowledge.
Tell them what you did.
It's helped me just a lot. Just skills. This year I scored 2 goals. I think my first 2 goals ever in squirts, and that I remember. It's just been a lot of help to me.
All right. Anybody on the committee have a question for the star of the show or anybody else? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just was so happy to discover this program this year because my son, who was 14, just became a hockey player. I can't believe he decided to do that, and he's doing quite well. But he's playing for Matthews Park, the Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis. The parks have a program for kids, for after-school programs, and they get this funding and buy the equipment, and then the kids at the beginning of the season, they go pick up their uniforms and everything they need, and then at the end of the season, they will return that so that the other kids can use it. Could you tell me a little bit about how that works for you for equipment? Because I understand this is, I think we would have not been able to pay for all of this equipment. It's so expensive, and so it's so great that he had, you know, he received this bag with absolutely everything in it. So that was amazing that the park board can do that. How did the program manage
Master
that?
Sergeant, go ahead.
Appreciate it. It sounds like very similar to our program. We got initially 100 complete sets of gear donated by the National Hockey League Players Association. And it's the same thing, man. We get a bag with absolutely head-to-toe everything that the kids need. So the family will come in. Typically, I'll help fit the child with the gear. Some of the hockey equipment needs to be adjusted. So we'll fit all the equipment, and then we put it on a hand receipt. We break the equipment down into expendable and non-expendable items. So the jersey, the stick, hockey socks, a number of the items are theirs to keep forever. But we do recover the pads after that current season so that we can sterilize it and issue it out to another kid the following year.
Thank you very much. It's a great organization. They can find out more about it, defendingtheblueline.com. And I want to thank you for taking time to share the story. And, again, congratulations. Oh, Senator Wigger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to yield first, though, to Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, this you're making me feel good about what happened a couple years ago when at the prompting of some fifth graders, we did get a bill passed. It took some effort to make hockey the official state sport. Mm. You approve of that?
TJ, do you approve of that?
Having hockey be the official state sport for Minnesota? No, you can have your own opinion. Don't look at them.
Yes, I do approve of it.
Mr. Chairman, that's the right answer. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Senator Wigger, did
you? Yes, well, thank you, Ms. Chair, and you know, we all commend everyone's efforts, and I just wanted to reflect on the expense, but as well as the great investment, hockey or just being involved in extracurricular activities. Each of my 5 children were involved in hockey, and the one that was deployed in Iraq, when we talk about equipment, she was hoping when she was there that she could have a hockey, a stick, and they used to play hockey. Actually, it was in Tikrit or Bakuba. They would just have a stick, not a hockey stick, a stick, and then have tape and roll it up, and that's how they'd play. Obviously, you're not going to have ice there or Afghanistan, but for the parents and relatives serving overseas, there might be some potential there for satisfying their need as well for back home as well. But my commendation to you, and thanks for all the efforts.
All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Mr. Chair and members, there is an opportunity. We are trying to increase the profile of the group. All of you should have received an email and another email that said if you want to sign up to be a friend of Defending the Blue Line, you have that opportunity just by replying to an email that was sent out recently. So we hope to see you on the list.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Second item on the agenda is an overview of the Gambling Control Board, and we'll ask Mr. Barrett to come forward, Executive Director. Please state your name, and you can start the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Director of the Gambling Control Board. A little tough to follow that act, but I will do my best. My plan is just give a brief overview, first of all, of who we are, what we do, how we do it, and then get into some of the specifics, some of the issues you might be hearing about later in the session, as well as some of the things affecting the industry that we regulate. But the board's mission is pretty simple, twofold one. It's to maintain the integrity of operations so that the players are assured that what they're doing, what they're participating in, is run well and to the best it can. And it's also to keep a focus on the licensed organizations, the nonprofits, and the funds that they raise, that they go for charitable causes. You just heard a great example, youth hockey. That's one of the main groups that are involved in charitable gambling and all the good that the proceeds from charitable gambling bring to groups like the youth hockey. But what is lawful gambling? There's a lot of confusion when they hear about the Gambling Control Board. There's currently five forms of charitable lawful gambling. Pull tabs, the paper, break open games, that's the bread and butter of the industry. Roughly 91% of the gross proceeds in charitable gambling come from pull tabs. Next item is tip boards. Anybody have numbers on the Super Bowl yesterday? Good answer, because those would be the illegal tip boards. But we also have...
Mr. Barrett, I was waiting to see who was going to raise their hand.
And Mr. Chair, with all due respect, but yes, there's the legal and the illegal, but there is a form of legal tip board. Only a very small fraction of gross receipts from that activity. There's something called paddle wheels. It's not the riverboat, but it's similar to if you see the Wheel of Fortune, that kind of a wheel, or stop in a local neighborhood bar with meat raffles. Bingo. Gaining in popularity, that accounts for roughly 6% of the proceeds. And then raffles. I think just about everybody in the state of Minnesota has participated one way or another, be it a church raffle or a youth hockey raffle. What are some of the things we don't do? Well, we work very closely with the lottery, but we have no oversight over the lottery. Tribal casinos, they have their own set of regulators. There's a watchful eye by public safety in terms of making sure those entities provide an annual audit. There's obviously illegal sports, internet gaming, the illegal side. That's where we work close with members of the Department of Public Safety, alcohol and gambling enforcement. When in our endeavors we might find some illegal activity, we work jointly with that agency. And you'll be hearing a little later, the Racing Commission and the horse racing and the card rooms are under the Racing Commission. Who regulates charitable gambling? It's actually a seven-member board. Five of them are appointed by the governor. One is appointed by the Attorney General, and one is appointed by the Commissioner of Public Safety. But the board is supported by 28 full-time equivalent positions, and that's included, I think, in your packet of information. Our divisions are broken out in licensing. If you want to be involved in gambling, you have to be licensed. We also have our compliance section that does all the auditing. We have our investigations when we get different allegations of maybe something that's not being done up to code, and then administration. How do we regulate? A couple of ways, but if you're going to be involved in gambling, you need to be licensed. That's from the charitable organization, the manufacturer that makes the product, the distributor that delivers the product, and the charity that sells the product, and then those paid employees of that organization. We also educate and train all the gambling managers, the CEOs of the nonprofits, so they understand what they're getting into and what's important in terms of reporting and maintaining a good operation. Before any of those games hit the street, we're doing the testing of those games. On average, we're approving the board about a little over 300 new games every month. And so there's a series of testing to make sure that the games are up to the standards coming from the manufacturers. We get into regulatory audits, making sure that on hopefully once every 2 years is our goal, but we've gone a little over that. But we'll go out to each of the organizations and take a look at their books, take a look at their inventory, and make sure that everything is up to speed. If not, there is the regulatory arm where we have the opportunity to initiate fines, suspensions, revocations. It's kind of the last resort. Obviously, we don't want to see a veterans organization or youth hockey organization be suspended or be fined, but at the same time, the integrity of the operation and reporting is paramount. How big is the industry? Roughly 3,000 sites currently in Minnesota conduct a form of charitable gambling, primarily the bars and restaurants in Minnesota. There's approximately 1,400 licensed organizations, similar number in terms of the gambling manager. Every organization is required to have a member of that organization be licensed as the gambling manager. But we also do a lot of exempt, tax-exempt activity, primarily small raffles. Now, we call them small raffles, but the value of those small raffles last year amounted to over $31 million in gross receipts for those charities that were doing that kind of activity. Minnesota's number two in the country when it comes to charitable gambling. We used to be number one, but we're now number two. Gross receipts are just over approximately $1 billion. We look at our counterparts in the lottery. They were in here last week, had a $499 million record year. Charitable gambling, by comparison, is twice. Now, you go back a few years to 2005, charitable gambling was four times the size of the lottery. There's been significant change, and I'll get into that briefly, but it's important to know the activity and what's been affecting charitable gaming. Smoking ban obviously had an impact on the activity in the bars and the restaurants, the economy, those things. But it's one of those impacts that are affecting the charity. We stay neutral in the respect of how it's operating, but we obviously see the impact on the charities when they were at this level and now they're at a much smaller level, an impact on the charities in terms of requests for funds. Where does the money go? Right now, 82%. Goes back to the player in terms of prizes. So every dollar that's spent, there's 82 cents that goes back in the way of prizes. 4% accounts for taxes of the state. Another 4% goes for the actual donations. 10% is allowed for the charities for the cost of the games, the salaries for the sellers, those kinds of things. But I hold up a penny because a lot of the times we're asked, what's the cost of regulation? It's actually three-tenths of one penny for every dollar spent goes for regulatory. So it's one of the biggest in the country in terms of activity, one of the smallest when it comes to regulation. Now, including your packet was the annual report, the salary roster, and a couple other things that we thought would be helpful for the committee members to understand. One of the new reports that just came out this year is what we call a star rating. And this was an outcome of a recent study that we did in 2009 where the legislature said, take a look at the industry and see what's working. There's some issues in terms of the activity, the finances. And there is some thought and belief that we were losing, or the industry was losing focus on what charitable gambling was all about. This report is an attempt to bring focus back to what charitable gambling is all about. So, and simply put, based on the contributions that a charity makes for charitable lawful purposes, they earn star ratings. And the minimum star rating is a 3-star. So as you can see in that particular report, anybody that's 3 or above is meeting the bare minimum. If they're 2 stars or 1 star, they've fallen onto our radar in terms of this next year. They're kind of like in the penalty box for hopefully increasing their activity or increasing their charitable contributions and minimizing the expenses. But it's brought instant focus for the charities that are affected in terms of what it's all about. I am happy to report that 94% of the licensed organizations are at or above the 3-star. It's the 6% that we're taking a look at. So if they don't increase to at least a 3-star this coming year, then they'll probably come before the board to explain what the issues, what the concerns are, and then we'll take action from there. Now, getting into a couple of things and the questions from the chair, and how do we contribute to the improvement of Minnesota? There's a couple of things. Obviously, maintaining the integrity of the operation. I mentioned it's a $1 billion industry. It's all cash. So it's paramount in terms of who's handling the cash, who's handling the inventory. And there's a lot of great charities, don't get me wrong, but in that kind of an industry, in that kind of operation, there's times when there are problems. So our focus is in terms of who's handling the money, who's playing the games, and how are they playing it. The board is the last ones that want to see a charity fail in respect to charitable gaming. We give them every opportunity to do the right thing, as we say. But when problems do happen, they come before the board. We listen to what caused the problems. Number one cause is when they put one person in charge of too much. And we see it time and time again, even though we educate and train. And so we always send the message out, keep as many of your members involved. By way of the reports that we share, obviously, to the legislature and others, that's the information that's very helpful to the charities as well to see what's going on. Maybe their expenses are too high, or maybe they're not donating enough. But we put the information out in terms of information is very helpful to everybody. We work close with the industry. As I mentioned, in 2009, we did a study. A number of issues came out from that study. Worked back with the legislature in terms of the changes. Got a lot of the changes done. There are still some wishful things, such as tax reform, that didn't get addressed. But there's a lot of things in that study that we took action, came back to the legislature, and got a change. We're aware of the issues, the board is, but we try to stay politically neutral. We'll regulate a charity regardless of what district or what's going on. But the importance, again, is the bottom line and the integrity. Now, how do we talk about better changes for efficiencies? Another one of the bullet points. While we're a board and not a cabinet level, we still strive to work towards automation, electronic reporting. I'll be honest to say we don't get much attention as a cabinet level agency does when it comes to the automation aspect, but that doesn't mean we're waiting around. We've taken our own steps in terms of online forms where they can go onto our website, download a form, and fill it out online. Problem is we can't accept them online, but it's one of the things that we're working on. We work real close with the Department of Revenue in terms of the tax reporting. Every month these charitable organizations are required to file tax reports, and they're working on a new system that we will be able to piggyback on, we hope, that'll send all the information to Revenue, and then we're able to disseminate back to us in terms of the gambling activity. It'll save the organizations a lot of time, and it'll save them some of the effort in terms of these reports as well. Education. Every gambling manager is required to attend at least one class a year. It's a continuing education credit. But it never ceases to amaze me as they come up on calendar year end how many have not completed the training. Right now, for the most part, our training is one-to-one, but we're out there in the field. We're traveling the state, my staff. We also take advantage of the American Legion, VFW state conventions, and we'll provide speakers, presenters there that'll help with the classes. We participate in industry conventions and seminars, but one of the things we're looking at is the opportunity possibly to go online with some of the training. So those gambling managers that have trouble getting out to one of the field classes could possibly take one of the online classes. We're not there yet, but it's one of the things we're working on. Another one of the changes is local approval. When the cities came back to the legislature and said, we want less mandates, we kind of stepped up and said, hey, we might have an opportunity for that to happen. Before a charitable organization conducts gambling in their respective city, they are required to get city approval. The old days, they would have to go back to the city every 2 years when license renewal would come up. And in my tenure, we never saw a city reject a charity. It was always an automatic renewal. So we said, how about once the city approves that local organization, that local site, we'll switch to a perpetual licensing. In other words, if there's no changes, the organization in the same spot, the charity's in the same spot, gambling manager, we're just going to keep the save the paper. We'll send out an annual invoice for the regulatory fees, but save the paper. Now, the initial reaction came back from the cities going, wait a minute. We like it when the charities come back before us and tell us what's going on. And so we encourage them, you can continue to do that, but we're going to save the paperwork in terms of unless there's a problem. So it's worked real well for the Gambling Control Board. I think it's improved some of the city, and they still have the opportunity to bring those charities back and talk through. Efficiencies for others. Piggybacking on the perpetual licensing, that was actually an excellent experience and opportunity, one that other agencies might be able to enjoy as well. If there's no change in someone's license, why change the paperwork or why ask for new paperwork? It's really saved. In fact, we were able to transfer one of our positions from a licensing into the compliance, the audit section. So that's been a savings for us. Could others learn? We hope it could. We've also had a very good working relationship with our counterparts in the lottery. The lottery's pretty big in operation. I mentioned we're pretty small in scope and automation. We've had the opportunity to take their surplus computers and equipment and put them to good use in our agency. But it's an example, surplus property within the state, great opportunity. The Department of Administration runs very well. You just got to be on the button if there's a piece of equipment that comes up. But we've worked real well in that sense. Our agency is dedicated funding. No tax dollars come to us by way of regulation. It's all based on the fees that the charities, their license, the manufacturers, those folks. Every time we approve a game, there's a small $25 application fee, so we get the game in, we do the testing, and then if there's additional testing, that's another $100 for the game. But it's all 100% dedicated funding. There is the penalty aspect, and I always take this opportunity to point out, while we issue penalties, fines, that's not retained by the agency. That goes into the general fund, lest we be accused of raising the penalties to fund our operation. But in those instances, and I think last year we had about 60-some thousand in fines. Some of the issues that you might have already heard about or you might hear about, I will take this opportunity. I know that I don't think the lottery's here. They were here last week. But for those that were here, I know they had one of their displays, innovation and products, and I did get a kick out of the fact that a couple of them, Progressive Bingo, $1 million raffle. Obviously, I think those got their start in charitable gaming, but the difference here is the opportunity to be automated, where they go online for the Progressive Games and the $1 million raffle. But it's the aspect of the issue of automation, I think, that you're hearing from the industry on. The games that are in play right now, the pull tabs, the bingo, for the most part are the same format they were back in 1945 when bingo first started, or 1985 when it was legalized here in Minnesota. I know there's a wish in terms of trying to automate those games. Regulatory-wise, we're neutral, but we've done research. We've met with some of the companies that offer these handheld devices or electronic devices. To the extent that there's opportunity to come here, we'll make ourselves available to respond as it relates to a regulatory perspective on how those devices could work or not work, some of the concerns. But it's one of those things I think you should hear about. I alluded earlier, a little tongue-in-cheek, on the sports numbers. Sports boards are out there. It's still illegal. And a lot of folks say, well, let's get the law changed in Minnesota. The truth of the matter is it's a federal law that prohibits that kind of activity. Back when it was passed, there was four states that were grandfathered in, to the extent that that's fair or not fair. But if you hear issues on those issues with sports boards, could we regulate it? You bet. It's another form of a tip board. Is it legal? Not according to the feds. Now, there's some talk of maybe changing that, and certainly get back if there's change in that respect. For right now and for how it relates to Minnesota, it's off the state books. It's a federal law that prohibits. Independent audits. In addition to the work that my staff does in compliance roughly once every 2 years, if they're a big organization, meaning they're making more than $500,000 in gross receipts, there's a requirement to have an independent audit done. And that's for purposes primarily of tax reporting. The state of Minnesota is the number one beneficiary when it comes to proceeds from gaming. Like I said, 44%, or approximately $37 million last year went to the state in gaming, charitable gaming taxes. But the independent audit is important. We want to make sure they're doing the right thing. So those folks, those organizations that are having the independent audit, make sure the cash is in the bank, inventory is in the warehouse. The other issue out there is the aging charity. 29% of the licensed organizations are veteran, American Legion or veteran. Obviously, the membership in those groups aging, and it's tough to get volunteers, tough to keep people interested. So we're working with leadership and Legion and the veterans, because all too often we see when they decide to get out, then there's this void of, geez, we used to have proceeds from gambling help pay for the Bronze Star markers or the flags for the 4th of July or those kinds of things. And so the reality hits that, geez, we need to try and get younger members recruited. But it's an issue that we're aware, and something I think you're aware of as well. There's also the increasing threat of fraud and theft. Again, it's cash business. And so the board's looking at ways, working with the industry, to minimize that exposure when it comes to cash. Obviously, all the players want to be paid as soon as they win. But in these times, when you have that much cash available for a what-if payout, it's a concern. We work very close with local law enforcement. We suspect that there might be groups that are working in different areas. We got a case right now locally that we think we might be on the heels of cracking. But it's one of those things that charities need to be aware of, obviously, and some of the concerns. I mentioned briefly taxes. That's a concern that we stay neutral on. But I will say of the five forms of charitable gambling, there's four different rates based on the games that are played. So it's a bit confusing. But to the extent that taxes are part of the industry, they're understanding that. But it's a concern in terms of if we're going to find a way to simplify it, happy to work with Department of Revenue, legislature, in that respect. And then finally, local issues. A lot of times we'll get calls, get representative senators. Tom had a charity in here. I said, I understand you suspended them or fined them or whatever. I make myself available. You might not always hear the full story, but at the same time, it's important to the board. It's important to you, obviously, to maintain the charity and what they do and how they do it. But I certainly encourage if there's issues, certainly let me know when we want to get back to them. And I will close here and then stand for any questions, but acknowledge my staff of 28 in terms of what they're doing and how they're doing it. Keep in mind it's a billion-dollar operation and a lot of good that comes from it, but there are other issues of concern. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. I just have a couple here. First of all, it's to me a little distressing when I read through the reports and I see some folks that raise an awful lot of money and they don't pledge a nickel to a charity. And I'm wondering if that needs to be changed in some way, shape, or form, especially when you're under the blanket of a charity. Has there ever been any thought or research done on if anyone that falls under that charitable gambling, if we were to say to set a percentage of even as much as gross receipts at a certain level for everyone, that would that harm or better charitable gambling?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the focus of that star rating is where we're heading, and I think in that respect, because the charities that that for whatever reason did not give a portion of their proceeds to charity, that's where it's going to come out first. They're aware of it. We make you all aware of it. There's some organizations that say, well, geez, we're saving up. A good example is Fire Relief. It takes a while to save up enough funds so they can buy that emergency equipment. I mean, big ticket price. But that's the focus where I think the star rating, this report, is bringing back to say, we're going to zero in real quick who's not making the contributions. The charities know that we're looking at it. The charities know you're looking at it. And so this is the first year of actually producing the report, getting it out to the public. And it's brought the awareness up. Hopefully you're going to see, you know, that 94% change to 100% maybe next year.
So with the star rating, are you saying you're trying to use peer pressure before you ask for any kind of legislation?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the legislation's there because it talks about the minimum. To the extent that they don't meet it, the board's view is they would be going against what the minimum rating would be, which is the 3 stars. So I think it's there. To the extent, is that enough? I bring up the issue with the huge decline. I mean, they've dropped 400. The industry's dropped $400 million in about 5 years in gross receipts, yet they still maintain a gambling manager. So it's one of those perfect storms where the receipts have dropped, the demand for charitable, be it food shelves, the youth hockey, those kinds of things, has gone up. So I know they're dealing with it. But I would offer that, you know, this one-year period right now, the report's out. Our hope, our expectation is those 6% of the charities that are below the 3-star rise up. Or they make the determination on their own that maybe charitable gambling isn't for them.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, sir, you had mentioned that, I thought I heard you say that there was a percentage that was, or a minimum percentage for charity, and then the percentage for taxes, because I was kind of comparing those two columns in the chart here, and there's some kind of interesting things going on here. Are there no percentage? There's no percentage requirement that has to go to the as a charitable donation?
Mr. Chair, Senator, right now we look at it as a 70-30 minimum, 30% being the what's officially in the law books is lawful purpose. A lawful purpose expenditures does include taxes, okay? But it also include the charitable things for whether it's helping a family in need, the youth hockey, or the veterans. So in terms of what's in law, it's pretty much established at a 30% minimum of the net proceeds goes for charitable lawful purpose contributions, which includes taxes. Now, to the trying to answer your question on taxes, as I mentioned, there's five forms of charitable gaming right now, and then there's four different kind of taxes. There's a different tax on raffles than there is on the pull tabs. And there's a combined receipts tax if the organization makes a progressive amount of receipts over a certain amount. Mm-hmm. Overall, on average, if you were to take that $1 spent on a pull tab, on average it's about a 4% tax that goes to the state.
So Senator Mr. Chair, Olson. Now, total lawful purpose, I'm trying to make, I thought these percentages added up across this spreadsheet that you had, and there was one particular one that has a, this happens to be something to do with hockey, but the charitable donations amounted to 1.82%, about 11,500, but they paid in taxes and fees 226,800, or 35.5%.
Mr. Barrett?
If they... Did the taxes come out first, and then what they've got left is for the charity, or how does that work?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Senator, you are correct. This is, I know, one of the issues that the charities have, but to try and explain as briefly as I can the way the taxes work, but if we were to take a box of the pull tab tickets that comes from the distributor and is sold to the charity, at the time that the charity buys that box of tickets, from the distributor, they're paying the tax up front before the ticket is sold. But when you're looking at the percentages, because what the percentages in that particular report are based on net receipts. In other words, after the prize has been paid, what's left to pay expenses and the taxes and the like. But on average, the industry is paying approximately 20-22% of their net proceeds for taxes.
But Mr. Barrett, let me I think he needs to. Now, the taxes, they're reimbursed for the game parts that they don't sell. Is that correct from that?
Mr. Chair, yes. When they pay the tax up front, they're paying on the assumption that they sell 100% of the game. If they don't, if there's unsold tickets at the end, they report the value of the unsold tickets every month to revenue. And then similar to an income tax refund, once a year, revenue will pay back to the charity the value of that unsold ticket tax.
Is that reflected in those numbers?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Olson.
But then I find another couple, one of them in my district and one not, where they actually had 31% that went to the charitable donation, and they only paid like 10.9% in taxes. And here's another one on the Hamburg, 41%. Almost 42% in charitable donations and only 9.5% in taxes. So what I don't know. Maybe I haven't. If they're allowable expenses, if some people are taking more out there, but there doesn't seem to be that much disparity there.
Huh. Mr. Barrett,
it's kind of odd to try to figure this out as to what's driving those categories.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Senator. Again, it's as you're finding, it is confusing. I think what you're seeing is the impact on those particular organizations that are paying a higher percent of their net receipts on taxes. Those are the charities that have a bigger operation, and by having that bigger operation, it kicks them into what they call the combined receipts tax. And when that happens, they pay a progressively higher tax, a disproportionate. But again, I'm trying to stay neutral. If there's an opportunity to explain in more detail the tax structure, but that's, I think you're seeing firsthand what some of the charities see when they're involved in this the activity.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barrett, I just want to make sure I have this crystal clear, because I do have a constituent that has this question. If I look at the graph on page 9 on the lawful gambling statistics, the 82%, so if we took $100, let's say we had a box of $100 of pull tabs, about $82 is going to get paid out in prize money, correct?
Correct. According to,
okay, and then so then the remaining 18% gets distributed basically in these three basic categories of allowable expenses, usually around 50% it looks like. So about 9%, and then the remaining. So I just want to make sure that is correct. I understand. Is there anything else that goes into the 82% other than the prize money? Or is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, the 82 is prize money.
Thank you.
Yep. Well, thank you very much. I'm sure your phone's always on and doors are always open if there are any other questions as we move forward on this, but it is truly interesting, and thanks for the five-star breakouts. It's very interesting, and I'm happy to see my communities are up there in the fours. So, all right, thank you very much,
Mr.
Barrett.
Chair, members.
The third item on the agenda is an overview of the Racing Commission. Richard Krueger and Mary Manny, Executive Director and Deputy Director, before us. Please state your name and.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dick Krueger, the Executive Director of the Racing Commission, and next to me is Ms. Mary Manny, the Deputy Executive Director. Did you do that? Mr. Chairman, I'm going to respond to some of the inquiries that you had in your letter that you sent out to us about a week ago or so. The mission statement of the Racing Commission is on page 1 of the handout. And, I can read that. The Minnesota Racing Commission was established to regulate horse racing and card playing in Minnesota to ensure that it is conducted in the public interest and to take all necessary steps in ensuring the integrity of racing and card playing in Minnesota, thus promoting the breeding of racehorses in order to stimulate agriculture and rural agribusiness. And how we do that, I'm going to just briefly go over with you the activities of the commission. The commission itself is composed of 9 members appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation. The primary duties of the Racing Commission are to review and approve the application of Class A, B, C, and D licenses, which are our licenses that are set by statute. The commission also has the responsibility of assigning race days. They have broad rulemaking authority that you have given them in statute. They approve paramutual pools and racing officials. They have oversight of equine drug testing through our veterinarians. They will review appeals to any steward ruling by one of our licensees. And they have broad authority to approve the card club plans of operation that are authorized for a Class A license holder. Now, a Class A license is an ownership license of a racetrack. And as you all know, we have two racetracks in Minnesota, Canterbury Park and Running Aces Harness Park. They also are the holders of the Class B license, which is the actual license to conduct paramutual racing. In both cases, we do a very extensive background investigation of their license applications, including a criminal background check and detailed financial evaluation and assessment, as well as reviewing their racing plan, their business plan, and other issues that are included in our rules. The legislature also authorizes the issuance of Class C licenses. Those are occupational licenses that we issue in our office at Canterbury and at Running Aces. And the fees for those licenses are set by rule. I should probably go back. The Class A license is set by statute, and it's $253,000 a year. And the Class B license, racing license, is also set by statute. And that license is targeted on the number of race days. It's $500 for a live race day and $100 for any day on which they conduct simulcasting, either at Canterbury or Running Aces. The license fees from those licenses are what supports the appropriation, the direct appropriation that the legislature makes from the Special Revenue Fund to the Racing Commission. The commission also has the authority to issue Class D licenses, which are licenses for pari-mutuel racing at county fairs. And we have only had one Class D license in the state, and that was a Traverse County Fair, which held pari-mutuel harness racing at the county fair in Wheaton, Minnesota. Our commission budget and staff, we have 10 full-time year-round employees. During live racing, we add another about 3.5 positions, so we have FTEs of about 13.4 positions. And about eight of those are funded out of the reimbursement account for oversight to the card club, and it's funded by one of the statutory appropriations that Mr. Lundeen reviewed with you a couple of weeks ago. On page 5 of the handout, you'll see a summary of the handle at the two racetracks. I believe that goes back. I don't think we went back all the way. Yes, it goes all the way back to 1985 when Canterbury opened, and you can see for the past years that that handle has been declining at Canterbury since about 2004-2005. Running Aces is kind of holding their own, but they've only had 3 years of live racing. It's the handle at the racetrack that drives the revenue for the operation of the racetrack and purses and the Breeders' Fund. And this is kind of where I cross over the line in my testimony at times, that when that revenue declines, you're affecting purses and you're affecting the Breeders' Fund. That affects what's going on your equine farms across the state. You know, are they going to invest in a racehorse? Are they going to invest in a breeding operation when they know that the likelihood of getting a return on that investment has been declining?
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. I'm sorry, but I don't know what you mean by handle.
That's, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, okay, that's the total dollars that are wagered pari-mutuely.
You can tell I've been there before. Thank you.
I apologize for that. I just want to briefly review the two primary responsibilities, staff responsibilities at the racetrack, and that's the stewards and judges and our veterinary staff. By statute, we have to have three stewards in the steward stand at all times during the running of the races, and they're also in the stand at Running Aces for the qualifying races that they have to qualify to race. They have morning duties, as we call them, and they have afternoon or evening duties. The morning duties are when they will be discussing situations with the horsemen, reviewing alleged violations of our rules. If need be, they work with our investigators to interview people and with regard to a certain incident. And if need be, they will conduct hearings. The legislature has given them authority to conduct hearings and issue what we call a ruling. It's an order that includes a finding of fact, conclusions, and an order. And then during the actual running of the races, they are, I like to characterize it as the referees of the racing event. They watch the races that's being run, and they do have replay ability up in the steward and judges stand to review any incident that that might happen during the running of the race. They have authority to, by statute, to suspend Class C licensees up to 90 days or to fine them up to $2,000 for violation of our rules. And they also are reimbursed to us by the racetracks, again, under that statutory appropriation. That's in 241.55. Our veterinary program is vital. It serves to protect the racing equine. Every horse that enters the ground We maintain a medical record of that horse, that it, when it arrives, how it's training, how it has been racing, what they might have to look for as far as anything that might have happened during the running of a race. During last year, there were almost 2,000 records that were maintained by our veterinary staff. We also do pre-race exams. Every horse that's going to race has a pre-race exam by our veterinarians. And last year, they conducted almost 8,200 pre-race exams at both Canterbury and Running Aces. We also have a medical testing program. At least two horses in every race are tested, whereby it's the first place horse and then any other horse, usually the second horse in the race, are sent to the test barn for testing. We take custody of the horse in the winner's circle, accompany the horse to the test barn, where we do take blood and urine from the horses, and the samples are then sent to our laboratory, which is industrial lab just outside of Denver, Colorado. And again, that cost is reimbursed to us 100% by the racetracks. Another vital function is the administration of the Minnesota Breeders Fund, which is in 240.18. That's a separate tax on the handle of about 1% on the live handle, and 6% of the takeout and simulcasting, which comes out to about 1% for the simulcast handle. And that money is paid to us, and it goes back to the industry in the form of purse supplements, stallion awards, breeders awards, and owners awards, I believe, in standard bred racing. And we administer that fund, and we're estimating that to be just around $1 million a year for the next biennium. To participate in the Breeders Fund program, horsemen and women have to have their horses in the state of Minnesota. The mare has to be here, and the horse has to foal here. That's the thrust of, part of the thrust of the parimutuel legislation back in 83, which was to get the horses in Minnesota. They're consuming vet bills, they're consuming hay, feed, and everything else that goes into, you know, what I like to call equine farming. And then finally, in the 99th session of the legislature passed the card club legislation. And the purpose of that legislation was expressly stated that it is the intent of the legislature that the proceeds of card playing activities authorized by this chapter be used to improve horse racing industry by improving purses. The card club receipts for Canterbury now make up about half of the purse fund, actually a little bit more than half of the purse fund. And a Running Aces, I'd have to talk to Ms. Manny, but maybe she'll have a better answer, but I think it's about 80% of the purse fund at Running Aces. So that legislation had an immediate impact in 2000 when they opened the card club at Canterbury Park. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will go back and try to answer some of the questions that you had sent us. Improving Minnesota, well, you know, I've mentioned it's the impact on agribusiness that parimutuel racing has. We also try to, as Mr. Barrett mentioned, try to, by regulation, provide for an honest game at Canterbury Park, which, and Running Aces, also to provide for equine and jockey and driver safety and welfare, plus the employment at the racetracks. Canterbury right now has probably got 300 to 300 people, either full or part-time, and I think it's the equivalent number at Running Aces right now. And, of course, it increases probably threefold in the summer when they both racetracks have live horse racing. What can our agency do better or more efficiently? One of the things we're doing right now, and Tom had mentioned it in his operation, we have a rule that allows us to audit the parimutuel handle by downloading the tote information directly to our parimutuel auditing subsystem. We're just completing that project, and we audit it to make sure that that each breed is getting its share of the handle, whether it's thoroughbred, quarter horse, standardbred, or Arabian. We have had some Arabian races in Minnesota. And the second step to that will be to take that data and transfer it to the subsystem in the Breeders' Fund so that we've eliminated dual data entry in our office of essentially the same information. Efficiencies that could be applied to others. About 5 years ago, we went to live scan for fingerprinting. You know, previously we'd been rolling fingerprints, but the legislature doesn't want us to license anyone that has a felony that's less than 5 years old. So we went to live scan fingerprinting, which means we get the live scan that electronically transmits to the BCA, to the FBI, and then back that same route. And now we get our reports back from the FBI normally within 24 hours, whereas prior to that we sometimes waited up to 6 or 7 weeks before we would get a criminal record back from the FBI. I don't know how widely that happens across state government, but I know there are other licensing agencies that, in my opinion, should be using that same technology. If we've got it in horse racing, I don't see why we don't have it for other occupations in the state, especially if you're dealing with disabled individuals or the young or the elderly. The other efficiency is kind of central to us. We collaborate a lot with other states. Minnesota's a member of the Association of Racing Commissioners International. I serve on that group's Model Rules Committee. I'm also on the board of directors. And the information that we share, we send them, they send us, model rules. We're trying to standardize the industry as much as possible because half of our licensees come from other states. And Canada, we actually had someone in from Switzerland this year that came in to get licensed, horse owner. But anyway, we're trying to make the racing by the horsemen and women more standard when they go from Minnesota to Arizona to Nebraska or Oklahoma. And that's worked very well. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to conclude my remarks, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions. One thing I would like to do, Mr. Chairman, is to work with your staff to set up a tour of the racetrack during the summer. And I've always said it's difficult for me to sit here in the middle of winter explain to you what we do out in the racetrack in the middle of summer. It's a tour that you'll remember if you come out there and bring your family if you get the opportunity. But I'll work with Lucas and Elizabeth to try to get a couple of days when we can get some members of the committee out there.
Thank you very much. Any questions that we have for Mr. Krueger? Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Final item on the agenda is an overview of Explore Minnesota Tourism. John Erdman, director. And do I see Colleen Tollefson? Yes, I do. Assistant director. Please state your name and start your overview, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Erdman, and I'm a director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. With me here is my assistant director, Colleen Tollefson. She'll be here to help answer all those really tough questions that you may throw at me that I'm unable to answer. But in any event, what I hope to do here in the time that we have left is give you just a quick little overview of Explore Minnesota Tourism, talk a little bit about our agency, some of our goals, marketing programs, and then, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to answer the questions you've addressed about, you know, efficiencies and what can change in the future. Just first of all, I want to give you a little bit of a background about our industry. Tourism in Minnesota is an $11 billion industry. Oftentimes, people don't realize how big of an industry it is. It's comparable to agriculture in terms of its importance. Almost $700 million in state sales tax is generated from the leisure and hospitality industry, and over 243,000 private sector jobs in the leisure and hospitality industry with $4 billion in wages. A couple of things to kind of put this in perspective that often resonates with people. 11% of all the jobs in Minnesota, the private sector jobs, are from the leisure and hospitality industry, and that does not even include shopping, and it affects every part of the state of Minnesota. The growth rate that we've had in leisure and hospitality in the last year in 2010 was the fifth highest growth rate in the country. So these jobs are important. They're an important part of our recovery. 17% of all sales tax in Minnesota comes from the leisure and hospitality industry, and that's up from 15% in 2006. And again, it impacts just about every one of you, every community throughout the state, from the metro area to northern Minnesota to southern Minnesota. This next slide that I wanted to throw in there is just a little bit of an elaboration about unemployment and educational attainment in Minnesota. And basically what this shows is that if you're looking at unemployment, you'll see the higher rates in the lower education ranks. And that's probably not a surprise. Those with a bachelor's degree have the lowest unemployment rates. But I think what's the reason I wanted to show this is because a lot of times people think of the leisure and hospitality industry as lower paying jobs. They're not the higher manufacturing jobs. But they provide employment for people in the part of the state that really need employment. Those people right out of high school. Those people looking for their first job. Those people looking to discover an area that they may not have discovered at one particular time. And so I know that the higher end jobs are definitely important, but so are the lower end jobs as we are trying to improve employment throughout the state of Minnesota. That's from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Leisure and hospitality sales in Minnesota, basically, as this slide shows, affects all different parts of Minnesota. And again, one of the things that people often misinterpret about our industry is that it's not just resorts up north. Over half of the economic impact of the leisure and hospitality industry is in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. And that's things for hotels, the business travel, the sports, the arts, the culture. So yes, we do, it is extremely important, perhaps a higher percentage of importance in greater Minnesota because those jobs are vitally important there. But the impact is felt all throughout the state. There's a significant return on investment in leisure and hospitality industry. For what we spend on tourism marketing, we bring $4.60 in new state and local taxes, $20 in wages, and $53 in gross sales.
Mr. Edmund.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Back to that previous slide where you're talking 67.9% Minneapolis-St. Paul area. In your studies, does that break out, or in any of this number, does that break out visitors from greater Minnesota and visitors from other states in countries, or is this just numbers that have been gathered through the sales?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, that's a very, very good question. The 69% is the spending in the leisure and hospitality industry in the metropolitan area, and I think you have in your packets some information showing county by county where those dollars are generated, and that is from SIC code, Department of Revenue, leisure and hospitality businesses. Those would be the hotels, the attractions, the amusement parks, and things like that. As far as the breakdown between residents and non-residents, generally, and I don't have it broken down by each segment. In fact, we were talking about that earlier this morning. But about half of our visitors are non-residents. The other half are residents. And it varies in different parts of the state. If you get into greater Minnesota, a lot more of those visitors are residents, people from Minneapolis traveling north. When you get into the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, they actually see the higher percentage of non-resident travelers.
All right. Thank you.
In terms of the rank, and this is sort of a different way to look at return on investment. Right now, we're 28th in the country in terms of total spending on state tourism marketing. This is comparing us to our competitors in other states. We're being outspent by competitors in Missouri and in Michigan and Illinois and even South Dakota. But we also rank 22nd in terms of total traveler spending, 18th in travel-generated employment, and 9th in revenue generated from leisure and hospitality industry. I threw this in there because it does show we get a very good return on investment, even though our rank is maybe not as high as what many of us would like.
You're a poster child.
Absolutely. I'm an advocate for our industry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
I do have a question on the bang for the buck. The a dollar invested is $4.60 back. Do you have a way of measuring if we increase those dollars if the return begins to shrink or if that tends to be that way a little bit farther out. I'm just curious where you get the numbers and if that would bear out.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator, those figures were gathered by a study by a third party that we went in and took a look at how much we spent on a specific activity. And then what did we get in response? Then we surveyed those people, and then we found out how much did you spend. And then you calculate against that spending for how much you spent. That's how you get the return on investment. But the reason I wanted to use that ranking is that every state does a return on investment differently. There are many different consultants out there that will give you a lot of information, Longwoods, Shiflet, others, that will examine this in different ways, and it changes. And the way that we did that study was based on direct mail, people contacting us for information. Now with the Internet, there's a whole different methodology of calculating return on investment. To me, this is more of a general guide that shows that we spend more dollars, that we get more dollars back. I do know that in some states, there's classical examples, like in the state of Colorado, that totally eliminated their tourism budget. They saw the spending on leisure and hospitality substantially sink to the point where they had to bring it back.
Continue.
Our mission, Mr. Chairman, is to promote travel to and within the state of Minnesota. We have about 6,000 accommodations, events. We promote not only the private sector attractions, but also the public sector attractions as well, the parks, the zoos, the trails, all assets throughout the state. Now, as far as our structure is concerned, we're an organization of approximately 58 full and part-time staff, 48 full-time equipment equivalents. We have offices, regional offices in Brainerd, Duluth, Thief River Falls, Mankato, and St. Paul, and six state travel information centers. Our basic core functions, we kind of divide it into four units. Our marketing, public relations, and research, that's where we do most of our advertising and trying to attract people to the state of Minnesota. Our market is primarily the north central region of the United States, Minnesota and the surrounding states, the Dakotas, Iowa, Canada, and Wisconsin. We also do a lot of work in terms of group tour and media relations and publications. A lot more to that, however, is shifting towards online. Our next big area is an area that has seen increasing importance over the years, and that is the operations and technology. We've just recently completed an entire rebuild of our Explore Minnesota database, which provides information on attractions, lodging, places of interest all throughout the state. We also rebuilt our website, and this area also deals with our distribution and our contact center as well. Our next function area is the industry relations and travel information centers. Those are the regional offices that I mentioned earlier. We also have a grant program that's important to nearly 100 different organizations all throughout the state. They're very small grants. I think the largest is $10,000. Some of them are like $600. We also manage state-staffed information centers and various partnership TICs, travel information centers, that are not managed with state staff but are managed in an agreement with local units of government that then does manage it on our behalf. And we also have an affiliate program of travel information centers throughout the state. There's no dollars or there is an agreement, but we designate other information centers throughout the state and try to direct traffic there to get information about Minnesota. Now, our budget right now is about an $8.3 million operating budget for Explore Minnesota Tourism. We have $500,000 in incentive funding. What we have to do to generate that, we have to generate money from the private sector. And for every $3 that we generate from the private sector, we get another dollar from the general fund. That's basically to make sure that the private sector is participating with our program. Also, as a part of our budget, is $325,000 operational grant for the Minnesota Film and TV Board for a total of $9.19 million. Last year, this is fiscal year 11. Last year, there was also $1.2 million in a snowbait appropriation, which went to the Film and TV Board, which uses to reimburse for film and TV production. I'll get into that in just a moment. I also wanted to add this slide here, too, showing the public-private partnership contribution, because we all know that the state can't do it all. This private sector needs to contribute and participate in our programs, and we're rather unique I think, amongst the states in that we generate substantial dollars from the private sector. We generated over $6.68 million in fiscal year 10 from the private sector. $2 million of that was in cash, and $4 million was in kind. But we use that to try to extend the reach of the dollars that we get to get more into marketing in Minnesota.
Mr. Edmund, how do you give us an example of that public-private partnership?
Certainly.
Specific, if you could.
Specifically, Mr. Chairman, it would go to some of the cash contributions, for instance, on our website. Everyone in the state of Minnesota gets a free listing on exploreminnesota.com. But for those that want to pay more for an enhancement, for a higher Google search, for a graphic ad, they would pay dollars for advertising. It was about $300,000 that we were able to generate advertising through the web last year. Our publications are almost entirely paid for by advertising from the private sector. Sometimes we receive those dollars, and sometimes it's in a publishing agreement. So that's another example. And then another example would be if we did a promotions, I'll say, with Holiday gas stations, trying to encourage people to go to Holiday Gas, fill up on their car as they travel throughout Minnesota. Sometimes there's not even any dollar exchange. We promote them, and they promote us in exchange for that. So we are constantly looking for those kinds of partnerships to leverage what we do. That's the fun part of what I do, actually, Mr. Chair. So, our budget breakdown, communications, 8%, marketing, research, 39%, industry relations and grants, 16%, operations and consumer services, 30%, and travel information centers, 7%. The Minnesota Film and TV Board, which I mentioned earlier, has a $325,000 operating budget. They must generate dollars from the private sector as well. Their match is a little different, $1 private for every $3 in state match. There was a $1.2 million snowbait program last year, which allows for reimbursement for film and TV production in Minnesota up to 20%. Now, generally, I just want to give you a quick little overview. A lot of you are kind of wondering what's going on with the tourism industry today, and we have experienced some very difficult years in the last several years. But right now, I think from all the industry surveys that we have done and conversations with our industry, is that we're coming off a difficult year. We're seeing some gradual improvement, but people still want to travel close to home. They don't want to go as far for their vacation. They're looking for what can they do nearby, because there is this pent-up demand that people want to get out. But they're also searching for value. They are concerned about their pocket. They're concerned about spending. So they're waiting oftentimes at the last minute, looking for a deal, looking for a park, looking for a trail, looking for arts, looking for those types of things to do in Minnesota. So that is actually helping to fuel a bit of a recovery. We've changed our marketing. For those of you who aren't looking at the slide, take a look at that photo there. That's one of my favorite. That's actual photograph. Eat worms, get gas. Eat here, get gas and worms.
Eat worms.
It always makes me chuckle every time I see
you.
That one.
Senator Carlson, did you get that?
Mr. Chairman, that's my business.
Well, we like to promote that, Mr. Chairman. We're encouraging travel, people to discover more, doing a lot more marketing partnerships than we've ever done before to try to leverage our dollars. And we are just switching a lot more into digital than we've ever been before. I mean, we used to do a lot more of the guides and the TV, and which we still do, but I think it's over 50% of our marketing dollars are going into digital, because that's where people are going to do a lot of their vacation planning. Our new approach is basically based on a simple concept that there's more to explore in Minnesota. And the reason that we like this concept is because it's very versatile. For no matter what part of the state you are in, whether it's more to explore in Brainerd and Bemidji, southern Minnesota, there's a lot that people want to discover. And we're building around that, which is the built-in brand of Explore Minnesota. We have a built-in a rebuilt database, new website. We're doing a lot more in social media. And in terms of some of the digital work that we're doing, we're trying to get our information on Explore Minnesota on other sites. It's not as much people going to exploreminnesota.com. It's people going to a resort and wanting to know what events are going on in their area. So we're building this little widget that allows people to pull that data from ExploreMinnesota.com, customize it as you see fit on your website, and then we all start promoting each other. And so we're doing a lot of that, trying to get our information out in as many places as possible to get cross-promote and provide people information to plan their trips in Minnesota. We have some new brand and new tactics, and I'd be happy to answer any more questions about that, but look forward from the exciting marketing of Explore Minnesota this spring. One other thing I do want to mention is with our industry, we've engaged in a process we call SWIM. It was basically a recommendation for statewide integrated marketing. And what the idea is there is that we as a state need to work together with other agencies and other private sector partners to better market Minnesota. We cannot be living in silos and only focusing on our own agenda, our own programs, our own partnerships. And if we start pooling resources together, we can do a lot more. And that was the idea that came from the industry out of this process of selling the state together, whether it's private sector or public sector assets, and we need to do more on that. There's a whole report, if you'd like to see, on our results of that approach, but we really feel that this is a direction as a state we need to go and working together better to sell Minnesota. We're also doing a lot of other partnerships, as I mentioned, with Department of Natural Resources, promoting parks and trails. We're doing some partnerships with the Minnesota Historical Society, private sector partnerships, and we're also having discussions with the Minnesota Department of Health to promote active lifestyles. Keeping in mind that there's sort of a common overlap of circles where health is trying to reduce obesity and get people out and active. Well, we have the perfect foundation for that, and that's travel throughout Minnesota. And so if there's ways for us to partner to promote active living tourism and pooling resources, I think we all can benefit. And we're looking at some private sector sponsorships for some of those programs as well. We're also doing some new statewide integrated marketing among different convention and visitors bureaus. As you know, there's a lot of convention and visitors bureaus throughout the state. And as opposed to all marketing to sell their own destination for meetings and conventions, we've realized that if we pool together, we can do things with much more effectively. We're doing some sales missions together as regions and cities. We're doing some trade shows and some other promotions to market meetings and conventions. We want to do more with sports marketing because it's not just the big-name sports that you were all watching last night. It's a lot of the amateur sports and the high school sports where people are going into communities and spending money in hotels and restaurants, and we need to bring in those smaller events to communities. We're talking about sustainable tourism and other multi-state marketing. We're doing marketing with Great Lakes states. We're doing marketing with the states along the Mississippi River, as well as North and South Dakota as well. The last thing I will mention here is, one of the last things, is that you have a report, I believe, called Tourism for Tomorrow. I asked our industry, what do we want tourism to be like in 10 years? And they came up with all sorts of recommendations in that report that are beyond just simple marketing, dealing with issues of the importance of transportation, dealing with the issue of business operations, dealing with the issues of the environment. These things are key as well as investment in travel and tourism to try to get a $20 billion industry. And if we were to get a $20 billion industry in 10 years, that would mean 271,000 jobs and $1.3 billion in state taxes for the state of Minnesota. So to answer your question specifically, what can be changed, we think that increased private sector involvement. We can't do it alone from the state. We need to be partnering with the private sector, and we need to do more and more to try to develop those partnerships. Create them with public sector groups, with private sector groups. We need to look at finding ways to avoid duplication and extending our reach. If we're not duplicating with each other, we're pooling our resources. I was referring to it earlier in some of our natural resources promotions and private sector partnerships. We can grow tourism at a level beyond that our budget allows. And we also have to be looking at diversified funding opportunities. When we're dependent upon the general fund with all of the demands that all of you have to address and the needs for the state of Minnesota, we cannot rely on general fund dollars alone. So we need to look at other avenues, other sources of funding, Many other states have diversified their funding, and I think we do as well. So that's something that can be changed. And then in terms of the inefficiencies applies to others, increased collaboration among agencies, pooling our resources for greater impact, connecting resources to the people. And I think that's important with a lot of the discussions, for instance, the legacy discussions. It's great we're making these investments in the arts and the history and parks, but we need to connect it to people. That's the reason we're trying to do it. It's for future generations as well as generations today, and to leverage more from private sector partnerships. So basically, I think we are on a road to partial recovery. We have a long ways to go. But in a tourism industry, it's more than just fun. It means jobs. It means direct and indirect impact. It generates a revenue. It impacts every one of you in every county and state in the state of Minnesota. It's a good fit for a recovery, and I think there's a real opportunity for growth. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy with the time that's left to try to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions any members have? Again, another fine job, Explore Minnesota. We know we have a lot of great places, and Senator Daley has a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you for your fine presentation. You had a couple of slides back talking about what can be changed and efficiencies applied to others. Talking about creating opportunity for new partnerships, avoiding duplication, extending reach, developing diversified funding opportunities, increasing collaboration. What are some of the initiatives that you've taken already along these lines, and are there things that we might do that might assist you in some way?
Mr. Edmund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think it's encouragement is really, we were talking about that earlier today. Is there any kind of legislation that's needed for increased collaboration? But I'm a Minnesotan, and I think we have such an incredible state here, and we have limited resources. If we can be marketing together, if we could be marketing all the resources of the state, the parks, the trails, the history, as opposed to doing it separately, and the encouragement that I could get from the legislature as well as the governor's office to do that, I think that will allow us to develop more partnerships. We're trying to do it on a one-on-one basis, but I'm constantly, you know, often dealing with certain silo mentalities, human nature to do that. I came from Carlson Companies, and there was a lot of silos there, and it was always this big challenge. But that's one of the biggest challenges that I'd like to be able to overcome.
Senator Lilly?
Mr. Chair, thank you. We have our education chair here with us today, and one of the conversations that has come up a number of times in the business community, in Itasca Project and others, is discussion about when schools start. What is the impact on your environment, on the state's tourism industry, if we were to change when we start school and end school? And how could we go about improving education while at the same time working within the needs of your industries, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's an issue that has been debated for years and years, and
yes.
It will continue to be debated. We are one of the few states in the country that has a post-Labor Day school start, and the reason we have that is because it benefits communities all throughout the state. Our tourism industry is very adamant that they encourage outcomes. We're concerned about educational outcomes and getting the most out of the days that we have. We feel that we need to hold on to the date of the post-Labor Day school start. There's been some talk about a flexible learning year and whether or not that would be a way around that. I think what I'm hearing from my industry is let's wait, let's see what's happened in southeastern Minnesota. Let's see if the outcomes have changed and kind of hold the line on it for right now. Meanwhile, I will tell you, Senator, as a parent, with my wife also working, when I look at the number of days my kids have off right now and we're trying to scramble to find out what to do with them, let's first look to the number of days that we have before we start looking at changing the calendar.
Thank you. I'm going to go with Senator Olson first.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the case you have made. Whether my superintendents like it or not, I have stuck with the resorts and the state fair because I felt they have made, just as you did, made a very the stronger case than in terms of on the education side as to how before a Labor Day start actually can improve student achievement. And there's a group that did get a waiver for the flexible learning year, and Breeze made the case to me that we should lift the Labor Day start. And I thought, well, if it got you to cooperate by going that route, let's leave it in place, and maybe more districts will want to try to at least cooperate and do it if that's still an option open to them. But I'm still inclined to agree with you. I can't quite bring myself to abandon the tourism industry and the state fair and all the wonderful learning for kids that goes on there for what hasn't been a convincing argument on the other side, to my knowledge.
Senator Carlson, did you have something?
Well, I was very intrigued by the sports marketing piece here, and I just was, for the record, putting in a plug for the Paul Bunyan International Hockey Tournament, which is a peewee hockey tournament in Bemidji that brings in peewee hockey teams from all over the world. We've had them as far away as Russia, Norway, we get California, and obviously from Canada. So I'd love to work together with you on that. So thank you.
Well, thank you, all Mr. Right. Chairman. Thank you, Senator. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I can just make one comment about Paul Bunyan. When you put together your promotional materials, make sure that Brainerd's Paul Bunyan really is the true Paul Bunyan.
Mr. Edmund, I believe there's a little back and forth here that we can deal with afterwards, huh?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. We do actually have Paul Bunyan on our website, if you'll notice, way on the top. I'm not sure which one that is. He's very non-denominational, though.
Luckily, we don't have Senator Sharon here, she'd be asking something about the Green Giant or something like that. But thank you very much. It was very enlightening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Members, by the way, your folders are getting pretty thick here, I've been noticing. So please, anything that you would like to save in your folders, please just write save on it, and they'll leave them there. Otherwise, they'll clean your folders out. I see Senator Goodwin already cleaned hers out. Thank you very much. I expect we will be having a late start on Wednesday due to the governor's state of the state. So unless I hear